Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV, recorded Thursday, February the 11th. On this week's show, nearly 13 million Brits have now received their first vaccine. Daily COVID cases have fallen to around 20,000, and daily deaths are almost at New Year levels. The more contagious and deadly variants of the coronavirus could still threaten progress. We'll start by bringing you the latest data from the pandemic from Kate Andrews. And we'll speak to Professor Sharon Peacock, who chairs the UK's Genomics Consortium. Then we'll turn to Scotland. The SNP is beleaguered by inquiries and infighting, but it continues to poll far away above the opposition. With critical Holyrood elections in May coming up, which could give Nicola Sturgeon the mandate she wants for a second referendum, we'll speak to Douglas Ross, leader of the Scottish Conservatives, about the battle unionists face. Following that, our political team will help us unpack the discussion, and they'll give us the latest from Westminster too. And we'll finish by talking to Wolfgang Munschau, director of Eurointelligence. He's written for The Spectator this week about Nord Stream 2, what he calls the world's most controversial pipeline, and the burgeoning friendship, apparently, between Russia and Germany. So all that's to come in the next hour. And this week, we have a special subscription offer for you too. For the first time in its long history, going all the way back to 1828, The Spectator magazine will surpass the 100,000 subscriber mark. If you sign up today, you could be our 100,000th subscriber. And if you are, you'll win a prize worth £5,000, including a year's supply of Paul Roger champagne, and tickets to our famous summer party, COVID rules permitting, of course. We'll also send all new subscribers this week a commemorative tote bag. So subscribe today, get your first month free at www.spectator.co.uk/100TV. That's www.spectator.co.uk/100TV. As always, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, and why wouldn't you? Because it's free. You'll never miss a program. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. A very special thanks, as always, to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to be partners with them. So, first, as always these days, COVID. Let's start by looking at the latest COVID data. The vaccine rollout seems to be continuing at pace. Cases, hospitalizations, they're all falling. So is it all pretty much good news now, Kate? Over to you.
Thanks, Andrew. Taking a look at cases first, we continue to see a retreat of this virus across the UK, hovering right around where cases were in early December, just as England was coming out of its second lockdown. A similar story is playing out with hospitalizations, which currently mirror where we were in mid-December. And when we're looking at this chart, we do have to remember that a lot of those people are under the age of 65. And if we look at deaths, the seven-day rolling average for COVID deaths is falling as well, back to the levels we were experiencing several weeks before we hit the peak of the latest wave of the virus. Now, I'm wary of hope these days, Andrew, but if you were feeling hopeful, you look at the vaccine race and you think that this might just be the last time that we're presented with charts so stark and so dismal as the ones that we've been looking at for the past few weeks. Because as the death rate falls, the rate of people being inoculated goes up and up. And this means people with jabs should be, broadly speaking, protected from severe illness from this virus in the future. And as you can see here, the UK is still storming ahead of its European counterparts with over 13 million people now having received at least their first dose of the vaccine. And I'm also delighted to report, based on the Spectator's vaccine tracker, that the UK isn't just set to hit its target by the 15th of February. It's currently on track to do so 2 days early, which would be this Saturday. We'll see if we get this surprise early delivery, but this all but guarantees that when Spectator TV airs next week, every person over the age of 70 will have been offered a vaccine and will be on to the next phase of inoculating the next priority groups. Understandably, the more good news we get, the more people want to know about what it means for reopening, and this is really difficult because the government simply hasn't laid out its criteria for lifting restrictions. This is a chart that was produced a few weeks ago by the COVID-19 Actuaries Response Group. Now, this chart estimated that we would hit the 15th of February target, which we are on track to do, that vaccines would be roughly 70% effective, and the recent data we have around the vaccines being used in the UK is that their efficacy rate meets this criteria. What it didn't account for was whether or not vaccines could, in addition to protecting people from the virus, stop them from transmitting the virus as well. And we don't have anything conclusive on this front, but some recent data for the Oxford vaccine suggests that it can reduce transmission by about 2/3. So actually, you could see this chart being updated to reflect a more positive scenario. But the point is that what we're set to achieve in a matter of days should, according to this modeling, reduce deaths by roughly 85% in the next 6 weeks and hospital admissions by 60% in the next 6 weeks. Now, you'll note that ICU admissions don't go down as much, but we know that in terms of who's in the ICU right now, a lot of those numbers are made up by the under 65s who haven't been offered the vaccine yet. Of course, these people are also more likely to leave the ICU and make a full recovery. But even if this modeling turns out to be broadly right, that's still a very meaningful shift. Yet we just don't know what level of cases, hospitalizations, or deaths the government's willing to tolerate to start restoring some freedoms. And they're not giving anything away. Apart from the target of the 8th of March, when they're hoping they can start to reopen schools, we are in the dark as to what might happen in the months ahead. Yesterday, you had the Transport Secretary and even the Prime Minister refusing to commit to foreign holidays this year, but also domestic holidays being possible over the summer. So it's really hard because what we're seeing right now is actually more measures coming in, even though more and more people are becoming protected from the virus. The UK has adopted a stricter quarantine policy in recent days. It's going to be implemented from next Monday, mostly done in the name of preventing new strains from entering the year, from entering the UK, which they fear could undermine vaccine efficacy. As you can see from this chart, unfortunately, the data around air passenger travel is only produced quarterly by the Home Office. So we won't know how recent policy will affect travel for some time. But you can see here that travel has dropped off significantly from the first lockdown, never coming close to recovering last summer, where it was before before lockdown started in March last year. The Prime Minister and Prime Minister's questions yesterday said that we were down to about 20,000 passengers a day, some arriving into the UK. So, some are saying this still isn't low enough. Others are questioning the human impact of these travel restrictions, even for emergency reasons, making it near impossible to travel. All of this, at the moment anyway, being done so in the name of a hypothetical mutant strain that the vaccines won't respond to at all. The World Health Organization bolstered the UK strategy this week when it recommended the Oxford vaccine be used for all age groups above 18, including the over 65s. Good news for the Oxford vaccine, good news for the UK strategy, but we simply don't know what it means yet for restoring our liberty. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Kate, for that. Fascinating charts and graphs. Some good news in there, but still some serious problems as well. So a harsh new quarantine regime for international arrivals. It was brought in by Health Secretary Matt Hancock this week. From Monday, people coming into the UK will take two tests during a 10-day isolation period. Travellers from 33 so-called red list countries will spend their quarantine in the pleasure of a government-booked hotel and pay nearly £2,000 for that pleasure. All of this, the health secretary said, would help stop the new COVID-19 mutations coming into the country from abroad. This seems to be the main fear of those in government, a new variant against which our existing vaccines don't work or at least aren't so effective, and that becomes the dominant strain. Central to tracking and monitoring these mutations is the COVID-19 Genomics UK Consortium, COG, or COG for short. They have sequenced more than 250,000 coronavirus cases, more than half the world's total, and are at the front line in detecting new strains of the disease. The team is chaired by Cambridge University's Professor Sharon Peacock. I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Professor Peacock, welcome to Spectator TV. But before we go into some of the issues, tell us a little bit about COG's work.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on the programme, and I'm really pleased to talk about COG UK. So we got going on the 1st of April last year, and we are a network of sequencing providers. So there are 16 laboratories all across the country. So wherever you're living, there's probably one quite close to where you live. Most of the sequencing sites are in universities, but we also have the four public health agencies of the United Kingdom working with us, together with the Wellcome Sanger Institute. So it's our job to take samples from people who are positive, to sequence the material that comes from them, and then give the genome information to public health agencies so they can use it for public health purposes.
Right, well, it's obviously essential work. And I think we always knew, or these experts like you always knew, that this virus, there would be mutations as time went on. Has there been anything particularly surprising about the mutations of COVID-19?
Well, you're right. We knew that mutations were going to happen. So the virus mutates once or twice a month. But I think perhaps if you were to ask me right at the beginning of the pandemic, would I have expected it to mutate as it has? I think one of the things that I didn't necessarily expect back in April 2020, when there were just a small number of cases in the world relatively, was that the virus would have had an opportunity to mutate in, you know, 100 million people. So every time a virus infects somebody, it gets an opportunity to mutate. And it can only mutate when it's actually replicating in somebody, because when it's outside of the body, it's inert. It's not replicating. So when it replicates, it has an opportunity to make a mistake in its genetic code. And that is when mutations can arise that are important. So it's had a lot of opportunity to mutate, and we need to obviously drive down the number of cases. But in many other regards, it's not that surprising, in that through natural selection or survival of the fittest, the virus will find ways to be a fitter version of itself. And from what we've seen, that's either being fast at spreading between people, and or able to affect the immune response against it. And so it's like a kind of waging a war, really, if you like, between us and the kind of evolution of the virus, which can obviously evolve much faster.
How concerned are you that as the virus mutates in the way you describe, that it could mutate in a manner which makes the vaccines that we're putting so much hope on at the moment less effective, or perhaps even ineffective?
We know that the variant first detected in South Africa has means that vaccines are somewhat less effective, but I don't believe that they're ineffective. And so that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is I think it's a story of hope in the UK, because the variants we have are fully, you know, the vaccines are fully effective against the variants that we have circulating at the moment. It's difficult to predict the future. And if I did, I would probably get it wrong. But I think the good news, again, is that we can tweak the vaccines. And so I think that knowing how the virus is evolving can allow us to track it over time, to keep ahead of that and change the vaccines, and then stay ahead of this as an infectious disease threat. I think it's going to be kind of an ongoing dance, if you like, with the virus. Understand, having eyes on the genomes, and then making those rapid changes to the vaccine. So I think that at the moment it's a good news story. We're in a good place, but we have to watch the virus evolving.
Does that suggest, Professor, that perhaps in the autumn or later, there will have to be some booster vaccines to deal with some of the mutations?
At some point, yes. I think at some point, but we're used to that kind of philosophy. So every year we have a flu vaccine, and we have to have a different vaccine every year because there is a different flu strain circulating. So I think that's within our own understanding of how we deal with infectious diseases. So it's possible that at some point we'll need to have a booster dose that's targeting a slightly different virus to the one that your previous vaccine was targeted towards. But I think that that's all within a kind of a scientific capability and ability of the government to orchestrate that.
I read that some variants cause particular problems, and we've been hearing about something called E484K, E484K. Tell us what that means.
Yes. Well, we're all becoming biologists, I think. And the reason that that is important, so what that means is a mistake has been made in the genome of the virus that codes for what's called the spike protein. Now, the spike protein is the part of the virus that is that works to attach onto human cells and then get into the cells. It's kind of their entry mechanism, if you like. So the spike is really important. And the spike is what vaccines are generally targeting to try and prevent that interaction happening. Now, E484K is simply reflecting a mistake in the genetic code, or a change in the genetic code. But the importance here is that it changes the amino acid that encodes, and that can change the structure and function, i.e. the way the virus behaves. And so this is particularly important because it changes the way the virus behaves. The virus becomes less susceptible, at least in a laboratory, to what's called neutralization. So antibodies from people who've had infection put against the virus should neutralize the effect of the virus. But E484K is a mutation that changes that dynamic. And what we know is that it's present in the variant first detected in South Africa and the one detected in Brazil, which we call P1. And now we've seen this particular mutation in a very, very small number of cases popping up in the United Kingdom in our particular variant that's circulating. I would stress that there's very small numbers at the moment, but that's why it's of particular concern.
This concern in the government about these mutations and particularly importing them has led to these much tighter controls on people coming into the country from abroad, particularly from the 33 countries which the government has put on its so-called red list. In your view, is this in order to try and keep a grip on the mutations and to stop the spread inside the UK? Is this broadly the right way to go in your view, Professor?
I think it is. So I think what we need is a two-pronged attack, and you can see that playing out now. So we have the plans for lockdown for testing, so we know what strains are being or viruses are being introduced, what variants are being introduced into the country, and trying to prevent that from happening. But at the same time, the sequencing effort that we've got going on is looking at viruses all of the time. And when we spot something that is of concern, and the E484K change is something that public health agencies are watching for, then that leads to surge testing. So the surge testing goes door to door. It tests people for the presence of particular, in fact, that's been applied to the South Africa variant. But in general, internally, we can use increased testing and then contact tracing and further controls. And so I think you have to worry about what's being introduced into the country, but also what's happening on your own doorstep. And we have the capability to detect that happening.
Now, you'll have seen that the success so far of our country's vaccine rollout has somewhat increased pressure on the government to tell us when lockdown is going to end or when the beginnings of that process will begin to take place. Do you have any advice or guidance for the government on that? It's a tricky one for government, isn't it?
I think it is a tricky one, and that's what SAGE is there for, to develop all of the evidence that they can give to government. So I think that I would leave it to SAGE to give that advice to them. But what I would say is, as we're going into a time of our lives when we are not so restricted, we'll have a combination of vaccines together with sequence data to look at what's happening to the virus. But I think we can't let go of the idea that we need to do, you know, hands, face, space, limiting our kind of interactions with people in a sensible way. I think that we will obviously follow the guidance of the government, but I think that we'll also always need to be worrying about hand hygiene and similar. So and I think that's a good thing, because we've seen the rate of influenza, for example, plummet this year, which is a very good outcome.
And finally, Professor, am I right in thinking, because of the work people that yourself have been doing and many others, that When it comes to genomics, which has suddenly become very important for us, a lot of people probably never heard of it beforehand, that in the United Kingdom, we are among the world leaders in this, if not the world leader.
I think that's right. We've sequenced nearly half of all of the world's genomes. So for the size of our country, that's quite a feat. And we're further upscaling our sequencing capability now with the aim of sequencing as many viruses from people as possible.
Professor Sharon Peacock, we'll leave it there. Thank you for all the work you're doing, vital as it is, to help keep us safe. And thank you for giving us your time on Spectator TV, The Week in 60 Minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, the SNP continues to ride high in the polls, despite having increasingly divided internal factions, a vaccine rollout that lags somewhat behind its English counterpart, a generally uninspiring response to the pandemic. No worse, but not that much better than the London response. Crucial Hollywood elections, Holyrood elections in May, could provide the SNP with the mandate they need for a second referendum. And the unionists are only just realising the scale of the task at hand. Douglas Ross is leader of the Scottish Conservatives. He's fighting to stop Nicola Sturgeon from getting the majority she wants. He joins me now. Douglas Ross, welcome to Spectator TV.
Delighted to join you.
You've been leading the Scottish Tories now for 6 months. When you took over, the Tories were polling on the constituency vote at 20%. They are now polling at 20%. You've made no impact.
Well, there was one poll this morning that actually had us up at 23% on the constituency, 21% on the list. But I'm looking at where we were at this stage 5 years ago. So in 2016, in the run-up to the Holyrood elections, we were polling at 15%. And we went into that election and stopped the SNP, who were on roughly similar figures as they are now, and we denied them that majority. So it shows it can be done, but the only party with the strength right across Scotland to do it is the Scottish Conservatives.
But, well, you say that, but looking at your own ratings, the favourability rating for Douglas Ross is 16%. The favourability rating for Nicola Sturgeon is 59%. I mean, there's quite a gap. Again, no real impact.
Well, it's really difficult at the moment when Nicola Sturgeon is on the BBC every day doing a daily briefing rather than addressing Parliament, as I think people would expect the First Minister to make her statements to Parliament. And I think there's ongoing discussions with the BBC at how they have allowed the First Minister to politicise, in many cases, these daily briefings and given her, you know, a very strong platform which other opposition parties don't receive.
But I'm still puzzled as to why you've not really made any cut through. I mean, the SNP thinks it's had a good pandemic, but the figures suggest it hasn't really handled it that differently from the Tories in England. The vaccine rollout has definitely been slower than England. There have been years of dismal results under the SNP now on education and in health. There are many inquiries going on into the Scottish Government and the First Minister. There's a civil war now raging in the SNP for everything from independence strategy to gender identity. I mean, if you can't cut through amid all that, when are you ever going to cut through?
Well, there's a lot in that question. So let's just look at various different points. First of all, on this perception that Nicola Sturgeon has handled this pandemic any differently or better than the rest of the UK, I think you're right to call out, because we have had problems and failures in Scotland the same as across the UK, and the figures don't suggest it's been any better handled by Nicola Sturgeon. Indeed, we had the shocking case last year where people that had tested positive in hospital were then released into care homes, and that was as a result of SNP Scottish Government advice and guidance. And indeed, when
why aren't you breaking through?
Well, here's the nub of it, Andrew, is when there is a vote in Parliament, when all the opposition parties say, actually, we need an inquiry into this as a result of these SNP failures, they fail to do that. They fail to respect Parliament. And indeed, we've seen that multiple times, that we can have a vote in Parliament, we can hold the SNP to account, and they simply ignore it. And that is unacceptable. And we do have this situation where there are a litany of failures in education, in health, in rebuilding our economy. There has been a sluggish approach to business and the economy here in Scotland long before COVID, and we've just got to keep hitting home these messages.
But why then are you stuck at 20% in the polls or in the regional poll? You were around 16% in the ComRes poll. I mean, if the SNP is as bad as you say it is in governing Scotland, it's certainly got a civil war going on at the moment, it doesn't seem that people are paying much attention to you.
Well, there is obviously a problem with getting cut through for politics at the moment. People are worried about their job. They're worried about their relatives or themselves getting COVID. They're worried about getting a vaccine. And it was right that the Scottish Conservatives led the charge against the SNP to get daily figures, so we knew how many people were being vaccinated. And that's why we knew early on in this process that Scotland was lagging behind the rest of the UK. Now, I'm pleased they've upped the ante and they've upped their efforts, but we are still, experiencing problems with the vaccine rollout here in Scotland. But to go back to your question, you're right to raise it. You know, it's difficult to cut through at the moment when people are focused on this pandemic.
Boris Johnson described devolution as, quote, a disaster. You rejected that description. But there hasn't been an opinion poll in Scotland now for almost a year showing a majority in favour of the union. And that the one last March was only 51-49. I mean, pretty much statistically nip and tuck. I mean, if you are a unionist, in what way has devolution not been a disaster?
Well, I'm absolutely a unionist, and the Prime Minister clarified his remarks. Remember, this is a Prime Minister who got that top job because of devolution. His time as Mayor of London, it ensured he was in a position to then stand again for Parliament, to become Foreign Secretary, and ultimately to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. So he understands and fully respects how devolution works. But like me, he's frustrated that after 14 years of devolution in the hands of the SNP in Scotland, we're seeing so many of our public services suffering.
And yet again, you have no chance of winning this election.
Well, we're a long way out. We've got to look at the opinion polls. As I say, look at how we are comparing now compared to where we were 5 years ago in this stage. If you'd been interviewing Ruth Davidson, you'd have been saying the exact same thing. You can't stop an SNP majority. And we did. We more than
Douglas Ross, we're talking about an administration in Edinburgh that's been in power for, what, 14 years. And is odds-on favourite to be re-elected again, perhaps with an overall majority.
Well, we've got to see how the campaign goes. As I say, Andrew, you know, if you'd been sat here 5 years ago, you'd have been saying to Ruth Davidson there was no chance that the Scottish Conservatives could have stopped the SNP having that majority. And they did. Many people forget this. But Nicola Sturgeon went into that election in 2016 with a majority and came out of it having lost the majority because the Scottish Conservatives more than doubled their number of MSPs.
If Nicola Sturgeon either gets an overall majority or is still clearly the dominant power in Holyrood and forms another government, and proceeds to hold a referendum without the agreement of Westminster. It's in the jargon, it's without a Section 30 order. What should the British government do?
Well, I know the Scottish Conservatives will take no part in a wildcat illegal referendum. I want to focus on Scotland's recovery after COVID rather than another referendum. That's where every political party should be aiming their strengths, their abilities and the might of government to make sure Scotland gets back up and running after COVID. But absolutely, I'm not going to take part in any wildcat illegal referendum, and it just shows where the SNP have got to. They just want a referendum over anything else, and they are not willing to focus on what needs to be done in Scotland over the next 5 years. They want to rip us apart from the rest of the United Kingdom, and even if that means holding an illegal referendum.
So just to be clear, under your leadership, the Scottish Tories would not participate in a referendum that was not sanctioned by the Section 30. And that you would encourage your voters or supporters to stay at home?
Yes, absolutely. Boycott it and show it for the reckless referendum it is. It's one that takes away attention and time from the real serious problems we have here in Scotland right now for our education system. The fact that the SNP are building hospitals that can't take any patients. The fact that our economy is struggling. The fact that our justice system seems to support the criminals more than the victims. These are where our focus has to be, and recovery COVID rather than a referendum, which, if it doesn't have that Section 30 order, then it is not the gold standard referendum that Nicola Sturgeon herself said the 2014 referendum was.
But if Nicola Sturgeon wins an overall majority and fights the election on a clear request for a mandate, to give her a mandate for a second referendum, and she gets an overall majority as a right, what, as a result, by what right do you have to refuse of that second referendum?
The fact that we were told just over 6 years ago that the 2014 referendum was a once-in-a-generation vote that had been accepted by both sides as the gold standard. That's how you agree for the UK government to give the Section 30 order, to agree the date, the question, all of this. Yet now, Nicola Sturgeon wants to rip that up and appease her nationalist supporters and say she would have a wildcat illegal referendum anyway. What does that say to people up and down Scotland right now who are worried about their job, worried about their school for their son or daughter, worried about their health service for their family who can't get into these hospitals that the SNP build that can't take any patients? It just shows that Nicola Sturgeon's priority is to the SNP, not to the Scottish people.
But in the 2014 referendum, the unionist side, your side, told Scottish voters that the one sure way to secure Scotland's continued participation in the European Union was to vote to remain in the United Kingdom. How did that work out?
And then the United Kingdom had a democratic vote, one that was agreed by Parliament, supported by politicians, to ask the public if they wanted to leave or remain in the European Union. That is how you deal with these referendums. You go through a process which is clear in law.
But you never mentioned that in 2014. In 2014, when the SNP campaigned on leaving the UK but joining the EU as an independent member, your side said, there's no guarantee the EU will accept you. The only sure way you can remain in the EU is to stay in the UK. And that turned out to be a fundamentally wrong statement to the Scottish voters.
Well, the Scottish voters also knew there was an opportunity, if the Conservatives won a majority in the election the following year, that it could be a manifesto commitment to have an in-out referendum on our place in Europe. But then let's also look at what the SNP told the people of Scotland. If you vote for independence, we'll pay for everything with oil at over $100 a barrel. Well, oil hasn't been over $100 a barrel at any point since that 2014 referendum, and that was certainly a misleading statement from the SNP, just one of many.
When we got on to this part of our interview, my original question to you was, what do you think, or how would you advise the government in London to prevent or respond to a wildcat referendum? What's the answer?
Well, I assume the government in London would look at what the Scottish Conservatives are doing, and under my leadership, I'm saying boycott it. Don't get into this fight with the SNP over a wildcat referendum that distracts from the UK government, Scottish Conservatives, and what I think every political party in Scotland and across the UK should be focused on over this next five-year parliament, which is recovery rather than referendums.
If it's a wildcat, or some would call it, I think probably you, Douglas Ross, would call that an illegal referendum, should Police Scotland, local authorities, returning officers, should they participate in the administration of such a referendum?
Well, there's two other people to mention before it even gets there, Andrew. What about the Lord Advocate, who is appointed by the government? So if Nicola Sturgeon is still the First Minister and taking this through, her political appointment as the Lord Advocate in a neutral way, but he is still appointed by the First Minister, must give advice to the First Minister and say this is out with the remit and the authority of the Scottish Parliament. And then the presiding officer of the Scottish Parliament, before any vote is held on an illegal wildcat referendum, should be saying this is out with the remit of the Scottish Parliament. How about, Nicola Sturgeon, you deal with education, with health, with policing? They're all within your remit. Focus on them rather than this wildcat illegal referendum.
So if Scottish ministers, government ministers, proceed with what in your view would be an illegal wildcat, your words, referendum, should they face criminal charges?
Well, they have to be answerable for their actions. Why are they taking forward these plans, illegal wildcat referendum plans, in the middle of a pandemic when not only we are still trying to get on top of the health emergency, we will have an economic emergency to fight in the next few months and years ahead?
So just for clarification, whatever the outcome of the Holyrood elections in May, Scottish Tories will oppose a second independent referendum under any circumstances during the next session of the Parliament.
Absolutely. I don't want another divisive referendum, and people know that across Scotland, the Scottish Conservatives are the strongest party to stand up for their interests, for Scotland to remain an important part of the United Kingdom, to benefit from being part of that family of four nations, and to give so much to our four nations of the United Kingdom.
The traditional response to the SNP's demand for independence or a referendum has been to grant more powers to the Holyrood Parliament. Are you in favour of that?
I'd just love to see the Holyrood Parliament using the powers it's currently got. You know, they jumped up and down and called for more powers over social security, and then the SNP found they didn't have the capacity to deal with that, and they transferred them back to Westminster and the UK government to handle for a number of years. So let's see the Scottish government actually using the powers it's got right now.
So just to be clear, you would oppose any more powers for the Scottish Parliament for the moment?
Right now, I want to see the Scottish Parliament using the powers it's got.
Are you worried? I mean, the problems the Labour Party has had in Scotland in recent years has allowed the Scottish Tories to become the second party. And in some ways, the unionist vote has coalesced around the Scottish Tories. But there could be signs with a new leader that the Labour Party will be getting its act together. Maybe not in time for the Holyrood elections, or maybe it will be in time. Are you worried that they could supplant you as the main opposition to the SNP?
Well, I don't think they are in opposition to the SNP, and that's the problem. Under their former leader, Richard Leonard, I offered to work with him to say, look, if we can work together after the next election to get rid of this tired and failing SNP government, will you do it? And he said no. So I then made the offer to Monica Lennon and Anna Sawar when they announced they were standing for Labour leader, and they turned that down as well. So they don't want to work with other parties who support Scotland's place in the union, who will stand up for Scotland to get rid of the SNP. And in fact, we see in councils across Scotland, they're actually perfectly happy to work with the SNP. So I think it's clear to people that the Labour Party are still stuck in this middle ground, and they're more likely to side with the nationalists and keep them in power than work with a pro-union party to get rid of the SNP.
But the May elections for Holyrood will be the first real test of your leadership. If you end up in third place, if Labour does become second, because we're all assuming the SNP will be first, if you're in third place, that will be a serious blow to your leadership, won't it?
Well, I'm not putting a limit on my ambitions for the Scottish Conservatives in this election, and I'm up for this fight. I'm really excited about the positive policies we're going to bring forward to take to people across the country and show the failures of this SNP government, and indeed the failures of parties like Labour who are not willing to stand up and be counted here.
But if you came third behind the SNP and Labour, that would be a problem for you.
I'm not going to predict where I'm going to come, Andrew, but I'm sure I'll be quite happy to come on again and discuss the results on Spectator TV once the people of Scotland have cast their votes and we know the outcome.
Well, Douglas Ross, we'll hold you to that. Thank you for the promise, and thank you for joining us on Spectator TV on the week in 60 Minutes. The leader of the Scottish Conservatives, Douglas Ross. Now, remember, if you subscribe to the Spectator's YouTube channel for free, you'll never miss an episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom of the screen. Now, political follow-up to all of that. I'm joined by the Spectator's political team, James Forsyth, the political editor, Katie Bowles, our deputy political editor, to discuss what they just said. James, what did you make of that?
I mean, the challenge for Douglas Ross is this, is, as you said, Jackson Carlaw was left with the kind of whiskey in the revolver because he wasn't doing well enough in the polls. Have the polls moved enough in the Scottish Tories' favour? That's the first question. Secondly, if Anna Sawar, as is expected, wins the Labour leadership, that will be a more impressive Scottish Labour leadership than there has been for some time. And so, you know, does that make it harder for the Scottish Tories to coalesce the union vote behind them? But I think you really heard the difficulty there, which is you listed all of the problems in the SNP. And this is the divisions in the SNP are spectacular, to put it mildly. You have the current First Minister and the previous First Minister were two biggest figures in SNP history at war, and with one of them seemingly intent on destroying each other. You have the SNP's most accomplished Westminster parliamentarian being sacked from the front bench and clearly not intending to go quietly. Yet, the SNP still have this commanding lead in the polls. And I think the question becomes this, which is, you know, in the run-up to the Holyrood elections in May, you know, can the opposition parties actually make some progress and deny the SNP that overall majority? Or are the SNP now in such a powerful position that even with all of these internal divisions and tensions, they can still produce a majority? And I think you saw there in that interview how difficult it will be for the unionist side if the SNP win a majority on an explicit IndyRef2 platform. The kind of the argument that now is not the time because of COVID, I think will work for a year or two, but I think it's hard to see that being a sufficient argument for the entirety of the parliament.
Katie, Mr. Ross sits on the Conservative benches in Westminster. I understand he intends to remain on these benches even if he becomes an MSP and leads the Scottish Tories in the Holyrood Parliament. How is he regarded by Conservative colleagues there?
I think there's a mix of views towards Douglas Ross. I think that if you speak to his colleagues in terms of fellow Scottish Conservative MPs, I think there is a fair amount of support there. I think that if you look at the difficult time in the 2019 election that Scottish MPs who were Conservative had, there is a sense that to survive, I think, is a bonding activity given several lost their seats. But I do think Douglas Ross's tactics in terms of how vocal he's been to criticise Boris Johnson, he hasn't really hidden some of his criticisms of Boris Johnson. In fact, he's given several interviews suggesting, for example, Nicola Sturgeon is a better communicator. I think that has ruffled feathers. I think there are some in Number 10 who think that is a short-sighted approach. Criticising the Prime Minister might help you be noticed in Scotland in the short term, but they worry about what that would mean in the long term when you start making cases for the union, that it could undermine it. So I think that there are some who do worry about some of his tactics.
James, let me come back to you. We've had this quarantine plan. It's been a long while coming for international arrivals. And then out of the blue, Mr. Hancock says that if you lie about where you've come from, you could face 10 years in prison. 10 years, more than you would probably get for killing your granny. What's the point of that?
I think the length of the sentence suggests a worry that people don't take this entirely seriously. You know, if there was a general public perception that anyone who lied on the form would be caught, you wouldn't need to have a 10-year sentence. You know, 6 months would do it. I think most people wouldn't risk 6 months in prison for a 10-day hotel quarantine. So I think in some ways it's an admission of the limits of their abilities to track people down. I also think it kind of risks being a slight kind of sledgehammer to crack a nut. It is so over the top that people struggle to take it entirely seriously. I mean, the government's chief law, Jonathan Jones, who spectacularly quit as the government's chief law officer, has offered to eat his face mask if anyone goes to prison for 10 years for this offence. And I do find it hard to believe that anyone will. We had a very good piece on Coffee House by a barrister pointing out that because of the delays and the backlogs in the court system, no one would actually stand trial for this offence until 2023. And I think it's hard to believe that in those circumstances, the judge would send someone down to 10 years for not having filled in their passenger locator form correctly.
The Tory backbenchers were in a rebellious mood not too long ago, challenging the government over the lockdown and so on. But they've lost a bit of that mood now. Are they going to roll over and accept this?
I think in the short term, they will accept travel restrictions. However, the 10-year sentence idea for breaking the rules on a form has definitely led to an explosion of anger again. And the usual suspects, yes, are coming forward. I think figures such as Steve Baker don't like it. But also you have former attorney generals criticising it just on a legal basis. But I do think it is reigniting that debate over restrictions. And I think this is all the lead up to Boris Johnson setting out a roadmap in a week or so's time on the way out of lockdown. And I think that the 10-year sentence is one thing, but there's a creeping concern amongst Tory MPs that the goalposts are changing on easing lockdown. And instead of just vaccinating and protecting the most vulnerable, this could be now about suppressing the vaccine indefinitely because of new variants. And I think that's what we're going to hear more about in the coming days and weeks.
All right, let's leave it there. I'm just getting some breaking news as we record this this afternoon, coming from Scotland. The Spectator has been in court to try and get what we believe are important documents into the investigation into how Alex Salmond's judicial review was handled. And according to The Guardian, The Spectator has won its legal challenge over the Salmond trial court orders that Lady Dorian, who was the judge, is going to vary an order, and it will now allow, according to this report, Mr. Salmond and Jeff Aberdeen, who was Mr. Salmond's chief of staff, their evidence to be published, something that the public inquiry, the parliamentary inquiry into this issue, has refused to do. So if that breaking news is accurate, and it comes from Severin Carroll on Twitter, who's a Guardian correspondent covering this, then that's quite a breakthrough for The Spectator. There'll be more on our website as the day goes on. These are complicated matters, though, and we'll need to study everything in detail before we're sure that this is a good result for The Spectator, good result for holding government to accountability, good result for freedom of the press. Let's turn to our last topic today. In this week's Spectator, Wolfgang Munchau writes about what he calls the most controversial gas pipeline in the world. It certainly is. It's called Nord Stream 2 and would directly supply natural gas from Russia to Germany. European leaders are furious at the plans, while Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said he's going to do whatever he can to stop its completion. So why is Germany sidling up to Russia? How will it change the EU's relationship with the US? Wolfgang is director of Eurointelligence. Many of you remember when he wrote excellent columns for the Financial Times. He joins us now. Wolfgang, thanks for being on Spectator TV. Just give us, before we come to the issues that are making the headlines at the moment, just give us a bit of background to how Nord Stream 2 came into effect.
Well, it all happened with Angela Merkel's decision to cut off the nuclear power industry in 2011. She decided to accelerate the phase out, and that made Germany more dependent on gas and oil for its energy consumption. And Germany is a country with a lot of manufacturing industry, so it has a very large demand for energy compared to most countries of its size. And the only country that was able to, or the only source of energy that was readily available was gas from Russia. And the idea of Nord Stream 2, it's a pipeline that goes from the Russian end of the Baltic Sea through Swedish, Danish waters into Germany, has been to supply gas directly from Russia to Germany, bypassing Ukraine, critically enough. And that has been one of the reasons why the US administration has been so critical of this project. And of course, because it makes Germany even more dependent on Russian gas than it already is. And the problem right now is that Germany actually is already dependent on Russian gas, because what happens if Germany were to yield to US demands and stop the pipeline, for example, in protest against the arrest of Navalny, then the Russians have threatened to cut off Germany from its existing supplies, and that could conceivably produce an acute energy crisis right now. So this is a real sort of almost life and death issue for the German government, and they are going to some extreme measures to make sure that this Russian gas is flowing and that this pipeline is, the construction of the pipeline is completed.
The Polish response to the problem of gas supplies was to build a number of new LNG harbors, places where LNG can be offloaded. This, a lot of it coming from the United States, which is now a major gas exporter. Was that never considered an option for Germany?
Yes, the Germans have considered the option. They have even offered to build a terminal. What has emerged this week is that the German finance minister has actually offered to spend €1 billion on constructing an LNG terminal. The problem is that the existing LNG terminals in Europe are not fully utilized in any case. And from an American point of view, the issue is that, you know, it's the dependence on Russian gas. Once this pipeline is flowing, there won't be much demand for LNG. LNG is a more complicated technology. The stuff has to be, you know, it's liquid. It has to be, you know, turned into gas.
It's more expensive to move around.
Yes, the issue is not, the Germans think it's commercial. The Germans think the Americans just want to sell their LNG to them instead of, you know, this is not a fair characterization of the American position. For the American, this is a strategic thing as well, because you know, Germany is dependent, it's part of NATO, but it makes itself dependent on Russia. So this is the American position. It's not only the Republican administration's position. It was the position of the Trump administration, but it is a bipartisan majority in Congress that has passed a law in 2019 to stop to impose sanctions on companies involved in this project. And the Republican and the Biden administration seems intent, from what we know so far, to follow this law and use this law.
So just to categorize the geopolitical concern about this pipeline. At base, is it a concern that Germany will be, for a chunk of its energy needs, it will be dependent on Russia, and that will make it more cozy with Russia? It will be less likely to stand up to Russia at times when NATO and the West and Germany's allies need to stand up to Russia. Is that the fundamental concern?
That is indeed the fundamental concern. And what I would add to this is that this situation has already arisen. I do not think Germany is at this moment willing already to stand up to Russia, because it is dependent on Russia already. And this pipeline will make it more dependent. And there are also political links between the Social Democratic Party in Germany and Russia. We remember that Gerhard Schröder, the former chancellor, is the supervisory board chairman of the Nord Stream 2 project. He's a personal friend of Putin. He once called Putin a first-rate Democrat. So he is, the social democratic leadership, including the president of Germany, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, is also very close to Russia, and this week said that the pipeline was something that Germany owed to Russia because of the Second World War. The social democrat run state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, this is the state in the northeastern part of Germany, has accepted money from the Nord Stream 2 company to build a foundation which serves as a way to circumvent US sanctions, because this US sanctions are not directed against state and government owned entities. So they are playing hardball, to put this mildly.
I've been reading your excellent article in this week's Spectator, Wolfgang. It does seem that there's a Russian lobby at the heart of the German political elite. Is that unfair to say that? And if it's not unfair, why is there this Russian lobby?
The Russian lobby has a long tradition. There is a committee called the East Committee of the German Economy, and that committee is very powerful. I compare it to the National Rifle Association in the United States in terms of its influence in German business.
It has
includes a lot of companies, especially the people who've been exporting to Russia. Now, they have complained bitterly about the sanctions that Germany, Merkel, to her credit, she was instrumental in organizing these European sanctions against Russia. But she also made sure that these sanctions wouldn't become would not extend to energy. So these sanctions are relatively, wouldn't say symbolic, but they are not as big as they could be or should be. And these people are now, are putting, there's a massive lobby, an industrial lobby that, that's influential in the SPD. Parts of the CDU, the Christian Democrat, Angela Merkel's party, the CSU. So these are the parties that are most likely to be, having these links to Russia. The party that is the least likely, or that is most opposed to Nord Stream, the only party that is opposed to Nord Stream, are the Greens. And we are in this extraordinary position that the US position and the position of the Green Party in Germany are completely aligned. That hasn't happened before.
Strange bedfellows indeed. the role of Gerhard Schroeder, former Social Democratic Chancellor of Germany, his role, looking from the outside, just seems extraordinary. I mean, Alex Salmond, former First Minister of Scotland, he was beyond the pale because he presents a program on what we used to call Russia Today. That's all. He's no longer an active politician. But Gerhard Schroeder's relationship with Mr. Putin and the Kremlin, I find it hard to think that any British public figure could survive what Gerhard Schroeder has done.
Well, the thing is, Gerhard Schroeder, survival is no longer a matter for German politics or for Germany. The German public is reacting similarly to that. This is not accepted. This is not an accepted standard. There is no law against this. The government has since sharpened the procedures against politicians leaving government and getting into the employment of someone. But in general, there is this is assumed to be his choice. One would assume that the United States would also not be able to stop Mr. Trump from acting the way he will act or wants to act after his presidency. there are certain
things
we discover.
He hasn't described Putin's Russia as a well-functioning democracy, but I understand Mr. Schroeder's come quite close to that.
He has. He's a personal friend of Putin. Putin came to his birthday, and they've been close on a personal level. But even Merkel, who is not close to Putin, when they meet, they speak Russian. There is a deep understanding in German, certainly in the German society or in the sort of political society of Russia. Russia is a country that Germans understand quite well. If you look at EU countries, the understanding of Russia is fairly high in Germany relative to that of other countries. And there is a link. I mean, I always think the Germans look at Russia the way the Dutch look at Germany. It's sort of the smaller country looking at the bigger country in sort of in a mixture of fear and admiration. And that's the relationship that the two countries have had historically.
The other geopolitical significance that comes out of your article, Wolfgang, is that we all assume that with the departure of Trump and with a more traditional American president back in the White House, a pro-NATO transatlantic president, that would mark a reset of European-American relations. There would still be arguments, there always are. There were arguments under Clinton, arguments going back to Eisenhower under Reagan, but that it would be reset in a more normal way. It is possible, is it not, that the row over this pipeline is going to be a huge spanner in the works of that?
I would think so. The Biden administration will change the tone, and it's already changed the tone towards Germany. But Merkel herself has concluded that I think rightly concluded that Trumpism wasn't defeated in the last election. Trump was defeated. There was a clear election result, but it was a narrow election result. Trump got some 70 million plus votes. Trumpism is still there. It might return. So Germany has concluded that, along with France, that they needed to be, autonomous in terms of its foreign policy. This is not, a description of the status today, because they are not autonomous, but it's certainly a long-term policy goal to become less dependent on the United States. But they are still dependent on the United States. So we are in this sort of position where these sort of ambitions and the reality are apart.
Final question for you, Wolfgang. despite the Biden administration's dislike of this pipeline, and many, I mean, the British don't like it either. I think there's quite a few European allies are not at all keen on it. The EU, as I understand it, isn't that keen on it either. But despite all that, is it too late to stop now? Is the pipeline happening, going to happen, almost close to a done deal?
The Germans were quite optimistic in December that they could get this done. There was this ship, this Russian pipeline vessel, which was dispatched to complete the remaining 5%. But the problem that has arisen is that companies in charge of certifying, of safety certification, have refused to actually do the job because they are subject to US sanctions. And as of now, there is no plan B for that. There is no company available willing to do this. Now, they might come up with something. So it is a bit of a race against the time. The idea is to complete the remaining 5% and get the stuff switched on before the Americans do anything. But so far, this isn't happening. And the interesting, when I speak to both sides, is both sides are absolutely convinced that their position will ultimately prevail. The Americans are absolutely convinced that they will stop it. And in Germany, virtually everybody is telling you that gas will flow in the end. So, you know, somebody will in the end lose out. And at the moment, I think that, you know, my hunch is that it will flow at reduced rate, that will be the compromise at some point. But this won't be easy to work. So there may be some kind of compensation payment that Germany pays to Russia or something like that. There is a compromise possible because the amount of gas you send through a pipeline is one can regulate it. So that would probably be, that is a possible compromise.
Okay, well, the story's not over yet, Wolfgang. We'll come back to you as it develops. But for the moment, Wolfgang Mantrau, Director of Eurointelligence, thank you for your column in The Spectator this week, and thank you for appearing on Spectator TV. And that's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests, and once again to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley, sponsoring the week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. Now remember, this week we have a special subscription offer. The Spectator magazine passes the 100,000 subscriber mark. Yes, 100,000 subscribers now for The Spectator. The 100,000 will happen this week. And if you sign up today, you could be that 100,000 subscriber. We haven't been there since we were founded in 1828. So if you are that one, that magical six-figure subscriber, then you'll win a prize worth £5,000, including a year's supply of Paul Roger champagne, tickets to our famous summer party, COVID permitting. We'll also send all new subscribers in this 100,000 week a commemorative tote bag. Subscribe today and get your first month free at www.spectator.co.uk/100TV. That's spectator.co.uk/100TV. It's been a week or a year of The Spectator of Zeros, our 10,000th edition published last year, and now our 100,000th subscriber. As always, send us your thoughts to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk and join us again next week. But for now, bye-bye.